I would like to read to you tonight a couple of prayers that were written by my guru, and it's from the book Whispers from Eternity. Now, these prayers have been altered since his passing, but these are his prayers in all of their original beauty. And he was filled with love for God. I have never seen anyone who loved God as much as he did. And the way he expressed it in such poetic words, and the beauty of his soul came through, and I'm sure that you will agree when you hear this. This is a prayer at eventide. The day is done, refreshed and sanctified with the sunshine of the day. I pass through the portals of evening, dimly adorned with faint stars, to enter into the temple of silence and worship thee. I worship thy spirit of approaching calmness. What prayers shall I offer, for I have no words to offer thee? I shall light a little fire of devotion on the altar of my soul. Will that light suffice to bring thee into my dark temple, my dimly lighted temple, dark with my ignorance? Come, I crave, I yearn for thee. And this one is entitled Prayer at Night. With closed eyes I sit in the temple of night and worship thee. The light of the sun with a million alluring things has vanished. One by one I have closed the doors of my senses, lest the fragrance of the rose or the song of the nightingale distract my love for thee. I am alone in this dark, dark temple. I have left everything, but where art thou? Darkness is haunting. But, unafraid, I am groping, seeking, crying for thee. Wilt thou leave me alone? Come, show thyself. The door of my memory swings open. Throbbingly thrilled, my heart looks for thee, but I find thee not. Halt, ye throng of a million thoughts and experiences past. Come not into my sacred temple. I close the bursting thought-pressed door and run everywhere to find thee. Where art thou? Darkness deepens, and as I sit still in deepening despair, I behold a little taper of concentration burning within me. I stand up and madly rush through the dimly lighted temple. The farther I go, the deeper the darkness becomes. I clasp the empty darkness in hope of seizing me. Finding me not, in despair I return again, and see the taper dimly burning. I sing outwardly a loud prayer. My large teardrops and my loud gusts of prayers almost extinguish the taper. I shall pray no more with loud words. I shall not rush or run about in the temple of Stygian darkness. I shall sit still. I shall not drown the taper with my tears. I command my breath to make no sound. I rebuke my boisterous love for thee. The taper of meditation burns brighter now. Oh, how maddening! I cannot worship thee with words, but only with wistful yearning. Brighter the light grows. I behold thee now. Thou art I worship thee. As night hides everything, I shall worship thee in hidden silence. At night all creatures sleep, but the night let me sleep in thee under cover of darkness, thou and I in lovely silent union. I am glad with the joy of all minds. I shall use the screen of the night to hide myself from the tempting things of the day. O night, when I am worried, throw thy veil of silent darkness around me. Create a dark temple for me wherever I go, that I may invoke and call him whom I love, at any time, anywhere, everywhere. And so he lived his life. My Bible chapter tonight is from Revelations chapter 13, beginning with verse 1. And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was likened to a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him great authority, and he gave him his power and his seat. And I saw one of his heads as it were wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. And they worshipped the dragon which gave power unto the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? who was able to make war with him. And there was given unto him a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies. And power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, and his tabernacle, and then them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints, and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world. If any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had 2 horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. And he exerciseth all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them which dwell therein and worship to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak, and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell save he that had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Now that's a very, very difficult chapter for anybody reading it to understand, unless you have been through the experience of picking up your own cross and following the Christ in order that you might become his disciple. I've chosen a very interesting subject for my talk tonight, armchair detective. And I'd like to tell you a story to start out with. One time, it was way back in the 1800s, it was one evening, and it was just at dusk, and there was heard in an inn in a beautiful mansion, a great commotion going on upstairs. And the maid servant, hearing this great commotion, ran upstairs as fast as she could to see what had happened to her mistress. And a man who looked very terrible, his hair was all tousled, he looked rough and unshaven, all the rest, ran down the stairs and pushed her aside. And as he got down, one of the tenants saw him. And as he went outside, there was a girl, 14 years old, who saw him. So when they went upstairs to investigate, they found that Marion Gilchrist, the mistress of the house, had been murdered. And there was a great hue and cry. And upon investigation of her home and her own personal quarters, it was found that a crescent-shaped diamond brooch was missing. So they sent out word and a description of the man, and finally he was captured and he was brought to trial. And they found that he was a German immigrant and that he ran a gambling house. And I've forgotten what his first name is, but his last name was Slater. Well, all three of these witnesses identified the man as being the one they saw. And so he was sentenced for life and put in prison. For 19 years, he stayed in that prison. And the man knew that he was going to stay there for the rest of his life unless he got some help. There was only one person that he could think of that could help him. This man was a very prominent doctor and physician in London. He wrote the man a letter and explained all of the circumstances, and he professed his innocence. And he begged this doctor with all of his heart and mind and soul to investigate his case and free him. So the doctor was moved by the letter, and he started from his armchair to do some work. And he wrote letters, and he discovered that the maid who had formerly been with this Marion Gilchrist had married and moved to America. He also discovered that the young girl, 14, had married and was still living in London. So he sent people to interview both of them, and they both professed a fear, a doubt, that they had fingered the wrong man, that this was not the man, actually, whom they had seen coming down the stairs, or whom they had testified against, that they'd seen coming down the stairs. And so further investigation with the pawn shop broker found that this man had brought in this crescent-shaped diamond brooch, but he had brought it in before the murder was committed. Well, this doctor took all of the information that he gathered to Parliament and pleaded the man's case. And finally, after 19 years of imprisonment, the man was released because he was proven beyond all question of doubt that he was innocent. Even the judge had been prejudiced against him. So he was relieved of a lifetime sentence. And that man, who was the armchair detective, was none other than Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who was the author of this great detective, Sherlock Holmes, the books about him. So I was reading that story the other day, and I thought, what a tremendous title for a sermon, Armchair Detective. Now, in this work, we are taught not only to pray with words to God, but we are given specific and definite techniques which are in the Old Testament so that we might sit and learn to concentrate, to focus our attention fully upon God within ourselves. Not a God who is outside of ourselves in the heaven, one that we can never contact. Not a Christ that lived 2,000 years ago, who is said to be the only begotten Son of God. Because Jesus himself said that the kingdom of heaven is within, and if he is to come a second time out of the cloud of heaven, then he cannot come any place except within our own consciousness, the heaven of our own being, when we are sufficiently purified to receive him. So we are taught these techniques, and we are led to a path where someone who has been through the spiritual experiences which are described in the Bible can really teach the truth. Because, as I have said many times, it is one thing to have faith through belief, but a totally different thing to have specific and definite knowledge through experience. So you sit in your chair with a woolen blanket under you each time to cut off the vibration from the earth, both morning and evening, hopefully. And you make your contact with God at the dawn or the beginning of a day and at the end of the day, so that you are dedicating the day to him, and then at the end of the day you are thanking him for all of the experiences of the day and making peace with him in whatever way is necessary before you go to sleep at night. And you should go to sleep with the thought of God in your mind and the promise of a new day and a better day each time. And you should awaken each morning, and the first thought that should come in your mind is God, because he is responsible for your whole existence. When you sit in this chair and you start to have experiences which God gives you, you are lifted up, and you find out the true meaning of what is meant when it says that He who will not pick up his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Now, as I pointed out before, every man on this earth is made in the form of a cross as he stands upright with his arms outstretched and his feet together. And it is upon this cross that the human ego, the Son of Man, must be crucified. You go through many experiences. You look for the light which Jesus talked about. The light of the body is the eye, therefore let thine eye be single, and thy whole body shall be filled with light. You listen to his word, which is the word Om, A-U-M, which is taken from the original Sanskrit, and which all of the Christian world calls Amen or Amen. And the Mohammedans call it Amin, A-M-I-N. You listen for that word. And as I told you many times before, many of you have experienced it. It's a very high-pitched sound which you hear inside. You learn to watch your breath and slow that breath down so that your whole body becomes peaceful and quiet. And even to the point where you don't have to breathe anymore, but yet you are fully conscious, consciously in control of your body, and you can bring the breath back into manifestation and operation at any time you wish. Now, this is called a state of suspended animation, and you are revigorating your body. You are not wearing out this body. You are not making the heart operate as it has to in order to keep all of the operations of the body going on. All of these things you learn to do gradually. And they are not offbeat things. They're right in this Bible. But don't forget that the word breath was in those days supplanted by the word wind, because the breath came through the windpipe. And so when you see in the Old Testament, sometimes it refers actually to the wind as we think about outside. But in many cases, it refers to the breath. And there are many, many what the Hindus call pranayamic exercises for breath control in this Old Testament. But they are put under this heading. So as you sit in your armchair, you are listening to the voice of God. And after you've been through certain spiritual experiences, which he alone can put you through, when he alone knows that it is time for you to experience them, and that time comes when, with all of your heart, your mind, your soul, and your strength, you have dedicated yourself to God, that you want your union with him. You want to be lifted up out of this world of trouble, of diversity, and all that goes with it, all of the so-called evil around you. And you want surcease from it. You want to feel the bliss of God's infinite presence. Now, in the Christian world today, particularly in one particular sect of Christianity, there is much stress made or put upon the mark of the beast, and great fear that that mark will be accepted by those that might choose not to follow the good path of the Christ. And then there is much stress put also on the fact that if you will overcome all of the things that you must overcome, if you will accept the Lord Jesus Christ as the only begotten Son of God and as your personal Savior, that the day will come when it is time for the second coming of the Christ, that you will all be lifted up together in a state called the rapture. I have been through that state. I was lifted up into that state. And I must tell you that it is a trap, because it is the highest state of human development. And you are still in a euphoric human state of consciousness when this so-called bliss comes to you. And it is not real bliss. It is an ecstasy, perhaps a rapture, and very, very tempting. You're filled with it. Nothing seems, you're in a euphoric state. Nothing seems exactly as it was before. And you reach out for it. You want to be filled with it. But you must have the courage to refuse that and go on. Because if you are to pick up your cross, which is your body, and follow the Christ and truly be his disciple, then to follow him means to emulate him in every single way, even unto death. And you must do this. And that death is the son of man within yourself, the human ego, which represents the ego, the gross ego of the five senses. And that is what this chapter refers to. Because it says, "And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy." Now the seven heads represent the spinal centers and the forces of good and evil within them. And this is the ego of the five senses, the son of man. And the ten horns are the ten subtle qualities of the mind, which contain the memory of all of the things that the senses enjoy. And it tells, it describes this beast. And in one place in here, and it speaks about after the crucifixion of the gross ego of the five senses, how the beast rises up out of the sea with a wound on his head. And the dragon, which represents the mind, again tries to seek the beast on the throne and have all worship it, so that the memory of the things that you have enjoyed in the senses is still with you. And if this memory can again promote, create, and foster the desire to express in the senses, then you are back again in the same state. "And I saw one of his heads as it were wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after it." And then all the forces within you worship this beast. You have a whole universe within yourself to discover. And the armchair detective, which is the soul at that time, is sitting in this chair, discovering actually the mystery of his own being, of unraveling that mystery, of finding out who the culprit is. And that culprit is the human ego. It is the animal nature of man, of every man. And that animal nature, which we inherited from the animal kingdom and which has been with us for centuries, must be overcome. It must be put to sleep. And you must use the power of God within yourself to purify and rise above all of these things which are keeping you in bondage. Remember in one place in the Bible where it speaks of the son of the free woman and the son of the bondswoman. And the son of the bondswoman is bound by all of the things of his senses. And he thinks that this world out here is the real world, and it is not. The real world is the world within yourself, and you create your own universe by your thoughts, your words, and your actions. When you get to this state, you start to get visions. And you start to get prophecies. And you get visions perhaps of things that have gone on in the past and of things to come. I remember the first vision I got when I was lifted up. And this was a totally unexpected, unexplained, new experience to me. And it was as though God took me back to the beginning of creation. I saw all of creation unfold, step by step. And then gradually I saw it peopled with all of the human beings of the earth. And it was a great procession. It was a tremendous experience. And you have that power to create forms within yourself. So when it speaks of the judges and the kings and all the blasphemers and all the rest of them, you have created these forms within your own being, within your own consciousness, and therefore within your own life, and you live with them. Now, when it comes to the final time, when you are to go through this tremendous experience, wherein God lifts you up, and he puts you through many things in order to take you to himself, so that you might transform the son of man, the human ego, to the son of God, the Christed one, heir with Christ, within yourself. When that time comes, then you are given many, many experiences. And when it speaks of those that must be killed in the cries of anguish, it is speaking of the torture of the soul. St. John wrote about it in The Dark Night of the Soul. It's a classic. And it tells of what the soul goes through. Now, each one goes through his own. Because somebody has a difficult experience isn't a sign that everyone is going to have exactly the same experience. Because God alone knows when you are ready to receive all of these gifts, to be put through this experience, and to be lifted up into the consciousness of who and what you are in Him. God alone. And He knows what you should go through. And you go through exactly what you have earned to go through. And that's why I keep telling you at all times to think good thoughts, to give forth nothing but love and understanding and service, to keep your minds upon God every moment through Christ. Remember, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody can go to the Father except through me, through that state of Christ consciousness which is within yourself. Then in here, and it says, if any man have an ear, let him hear. In other words, the Bible is written in parables. And only when you have dedicated and surrendered yourself totally to God does He start to reveal what these scriptures really mean. And many are led into captivity. Many are killed. And these are the thought forms which you have built within yourself. And then it says, and I beheld another beast coming out of the earth. And he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. Now that is the good thief. But he's still a thief, even as the bad thief is. And he keeps you in a state of duality. He keeps you from realizing your oneness with God. And he exercises all the power of the first beast before him, and causes the earth and them which dwell thereon to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. That's the ego of the five senses. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on earth in the sight of men. And again, we're speaking of the serpent force in the spine. Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness. And that wilderness is within yourself, because you live in the midst of a jungle. And so this kundalini fire, as the Hindus call it, and the serpent force, which the Christians call it, starts to rise in the spine, and your whole body feels sometimes as though it's being burned with electricity. It's quite an experience. But it is a purifying experience, because fire cleanses. And there's much deceit, and this opposing force, or the bad thief, tries to tempt you with all sorts of visions to keep you enslaved in the senses. And the good thief tries to tell the soul that he must reach up for God and do all of the things that are good. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast. So that again is your consciousness, which gives power to the ego sense, which wants to express itself through the pleasures of the senses. And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Then it says, here is wisdom. Let him that understanding, that hath understanding, count the number of the beast. For it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Now, in all the Pentecostal faith, they are very frightened at the moment, and they tell you, don't let anybody put the mark of the beast upon you. So I've asked some of them what they mean when they say, don't let them put the mark of the beast. What is the mark? And they said, well, they put it on your right hand or on your forehead. And I said, what is it they put on there? Well, it's like a stamp, a luminescent stamp that they put on. Well, they used to do this in dance halls or in places where you went for amusement, so that if you went out for a breath of fresh air, you'd have this invisible, it was invisible in the light, stamp on your hand, but in the fluorescent light, they would be able to see that you had paid your way in, and they'd let you in again. And this isn't what it means at all. In the first place, man himself is made like the Trinity. He first is created through the joining together of the ovum and the spermatozoa. And so there is the one seed, or the father Abraham, from which comes forth all of the begats in the Bible. And so the first set of begats, there are three of them, has to do with the creation of the idea body, because everything in this world is created by idea form, in idea form first. You cannot create anything outside of yourself unless you first think. You get a thought, and that thought takes form. You cannot think without creating a thought of a person, a place, or a thing. It's literally impossible. And so you create this thought. And so the body is first created through thought. And there are seven spinal centers, or as it tells about, having seven heads and ten horns. But you have the main powerhouse, which is the head. And the life force enters the body through the medulla, goes straight through to the Christ center, and is distributed through the brain, and then goes down to the six sub-powerhouses, each of one which controls a certain part of your body. And so this body is formed, and next comes the electrical or the astral body. And that is the body which controls your nervous system. And as you see pictures of saints and pictures of the Christ, and pictures of many of the Eastern saints, you see a great halo around them, or you see a great light all around the body, an aura. And that aura you can see, if you have the eyes to see, on anyone. And the auras are different colors depending on the life of the individual and the state of the consciousness of that particular individual. And so this light shines forth, and when you see a great light, like a yellow light surrounding the body of an individual, if you see the body disappear, only the outline there, and the body filled with light, know that that soul is a great soul. But only those who have eyes to see can see it. I remember attending lectures that my guru gave many, many years ago. And as I looked at him, all of a sudden his body would disappear. I'd see merely this dark outline. And then that light would take over, would fill his body, and would expand until it was over the whole platform. And there was nothing but light. I had such an experience one night, and then as I looked around the room, I saw the same thing all over. It was just as though I saw the form, and the whole room was filled with lights and all these outlines, but there was light inside, outside. I thought I was hallucinating. I closed my eyes, and I didn't know just exactly how to handle it. I opened them and still it was there. And no matter how many times I did it, still it was. I was having a spiritual experience. Because of my own love for God, I was lifted up. And I actually saw this. So then, finally and last, comes the physical or the gross body. And we call this body I, my body. But who is the I that has this body? It has a body, it has a mind, it has a soul. So it has these things. It wears them as a garment, but it is not these things. It lives in the midst of this temple, which is the temple of the living God. And it is God himself who sits on the throne of your consciousness, who governs and controls and watches every moment of your life, every movement of your life. And so this is the number of the human man, with the six centers, each one joined together. Three bodies with six centers, 666, which it says right here, let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. So that is the true meaning of the number of the beast. That is the mark of the beast. Until each man, each human being, rises above this human consciousness, then he is still in that animal consciousness. He is still the Son of Man. Even as it tells that Jesus was born the Son of Man. And he became the Christed One after the crucifixion. His birth was foretold, but it is foretold in every single man, not just in one, because it says that he is the firstborn of every creature. In Colossians, it says that. St. Paul says that. So it is the Christ in you, and you have to lift yourself above these animal tendencies. You have to open your heart to God. You have to live the good life. You have to love God with all of your heart, your mind, your soul, and your strength. You have to love everyone as Christ has loved us, and your neighbor as yourself. And don't forget that neighbor is just not the one who lives next door. But it is every man, woman, and child in this whole universe. Because we are all neighbors. Some of us live a little bit farther away than others. But we have all of these neighbors. They are all our brothers and sisters. Because there is but one Father God. Now you hear many explanations, as I say, about this mark of the beast. But I'm telling you the truth because I sat an armchair detective. I went through the experiences first. And always God would put me through the experience first. And then he would take me to the Bible and say to me, this is what you have just experienced. In other words, I had to be tested. I wasn't given the information first. And then could go through the experience with some knowledge of what I was going to go through. Rather, I was lifted up totally. I'd never heard of anything like this. Never. In all of the services that I attended, never in any of the words that I'd heard from a priest or a minister or a rabbi, had I in my wildest dreams imagined the truth of what I actually experienced. But I had to be tested. I had to prove my love for God. I have had to lift up that Son of Man. And having lifted him up, I had to go through the experience of crucifixion or transformation within myself. And when I did that, then I had to descend into the hell or the subconscious of my own being and face all of my actions for perhaps not only this lifetime, but many lifetimes. And I had to be lifted up again. I had to arise from the dead. And I had to appear to the 12 disciples or the 12 powers within myself. And whereas I gave up the ghost or the human ego, that is the ghost of the real self or God, then I was filled with the power of the Holy Ghost or the divine ego, because man cannot live upon this earth in a human body without an ego, without a center. And so I went through all of these experiences, and as I went through them, then God would take me back to the Bible and say, this is the true meaning of it. This is the truth behind the parables. Now, any Orthodox Christian can argue with me as long as they want. And they could not make me deviate from my statements of truth one iota, because I have lived the experience. And because they happen to have faith through belief in what they have been told, much of it erroneous, because the ones that have taught them have not taken the trouble to really realize and read what this Bible says. It doesn't affect me in the least, because even if I were to be killed for it, if I were to die for it, I would still stand, because I know, because I experienced it. I paid the price. And so that's how I can stand up here and tell you the truth. And I can help you to avoid this human rapture. You may taste it. You may go through a bit of it. But go through it. Be willing to go through the experiences necessary through purgatory, if you will, or the purging of all that is not of God within your body, and be lifted up into the heaven of your own beings. And you do that by living the life, by following God's commandments, by emulating the Christ in all the things that we are told about him. He was a good man. He was not interested in the priests, the Pharisees, the Sadducees at all. In fact, he spoke out against them. But rather, he consorted with publicans and sinners. Women, the woman taken in adultery. These were the ones that he came to save. These were the ones that he gave his life for. These were the ones that he spent all of the time preaching to. And what I am trying to do, what I am here for, is to teach you the methods, the love, the devotion, that you may go inside of yourself and find the Christ in you. Use all that is given us of the universal Christ and pick up your cross and follow him. in order that you might be his disciple. And it is only when you do this, when you go past the sixth center into the seventh, the thousand-petaled lotus of the brain, as the Hindus call it, when the whole being opens up and the body is filled with light, and then the serpent force goes through and on top of the brain, it goes through the brain and on top, and that's why you see the serpent as a symbol on the top of the Mother Kali in India and the god Shiva, because evil has gone out and there is no one there but God, God alone in that form. So keep your minds on him. Pray to him. Meditate upon him. Listen to him. Open yourselves up to your feeling. Open your hearts and give love and service to everyone you meet. And watch the tongue. Watch the tongue. That little cannonball, the tongue, can do more damage than anything in the world. But if you learn to keep a prayer to God on your lips at all times, the day will come when you repeat just one phrase, Lord, make me perfect in thee, and say it over and over again with full conscious knowledge of what you are saying. Lord, I want to be perfect in thee. I want to find my oneness with thee. I want to overcome this humanness within myself, this duality. If you do that, you won't live, as I've told you, in a never-never land. But for the first time in your life, you will know who and what you are. And you will actually know the meaning of life and how to live it. And it will be a life of peace, of happiness, of joy, of love, of beauty, of accomplishment, and of the bliss of God. And you will know that what you had was a life of darkness, a life of nothingness, a life of torture. Because there is nothing all over the universe that now you cannot enjoy because you have paid that price. You have risen above the law. You are no longer subject to it. And from the Son of Man, you have become an heir with Christ. The Christ is one, the Son of God. And so the story, the parable about the prodigal son comes into being. And when you finally, having turned your face away from God through an eternity perhaps, have again turned your face toward him. And he welcomes you with open arms, and he spreads before you his great banquet feast of love. And he picks you up in his arms of everlasting bliss, and he holds you safe forevermore. Believe me, it is worth every single thing, every price you would think that you have to pay. Don't be laggards. Reach out for the millennium. Reach out for the maximum of that which you can be and that which you can experience in God. Because God is all of life. And you are he in human form.